Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in live this Sunday night, September the 9th. We're responding to arguments for abortion rights. I wonder about that term, abortion rights or reproductive rights. We'll get to the whole rights issue as time goes by with Greg Kokel. We want to hear from you as well. If you've heard an argument for abortion that's left you a bit stymied, or if you've been presented with something passing itself off as an argument, you didn't think it held much water, but you did not know how to respond, we want to hear from you. Our call-in number tonight, live this Sunday, the 9th of September, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Greg, welcome back.
Thanks, Todd.
This email comes from Frank in Las Vegas. He asks, do you think that the entire issue of abortion actually is a result of what you and Francis Beckwith addressed in your book on relativism? In this postmodern age, it seems that the argument that what is true for you is not necessarily true for another person seems to be an underlying logic in the woman's rights argument often used to justify abortion. Your thoughts, Greg?
Yeah, I think that's a very good observation. It certainly is a contributing factor. Frank and I argue in our book on relativism that, and incidentally, Frank Beckwith has just released a new book on defending life, entitled Defending Life, A Moral and Legal Case Against Abortion Choice. I don't know if you're aware of that, Todd, but it just came out. It's his rewrite of Politically Correct Death, and it's really exceptional, so you might want to keep that in mind.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, he actually addresses the issue of relativism early on in the book because he understands that this is going to be, in a sense, a stumbling block for some in taking this issue of life seriously. And in this sense, though we argue in our book that there are no real relativists, that each person really knows that there are moral obligations, and you can't, and they can't even argue against moral truth without somehow subtly asserting moral truth at the same time. Even so, it is a convenient way of people trying to put distance between themselves and certain particular moral obligations. So, for example, the person, you know, says, well, look, relativism is true, therefore you thinking that abortion is wrong is just your point of view, therefore it's wrong for you to push your moral point of view on us. Well, wait a minute, what does he mean that it's wrong for us to do so? If relativism is true, then there can't be anything that's wrong for us to do. If they want to say that relativism is the way things are and a woman has a right to her own body, well, you can't have relativism and rights together in the same sentence. It doesn't work because rights are moral claims. They're moral obligations. And if there are no moral obligations, there are no rights. And so this is an example about how even when people are trying to assert relativism to protect their own turf, as it were, they still have to assert objective morality in order to kind of make their case. And this happens all the time, Todd. So, ultimately, this doesn't work, nor just as virtually no bid for relativism works in these kinds of issues. It still is a popular ploy by people to kind of become relativists when it's convenient for them and to be objectivists with regards to morality when it suits their purposes. And so if people are familiar with this and they know the move, and Frank and I both write in our respective parts in the book on relativism, feet firmly planted in midair, on how this plays out, and especially in the abortion issue, if you're alert to that, you'll see it coming, and then you'll know how to challenge it in appropriate ways.
Susan in Tupelo, Mississippi, emails us, the arguments used that women use in favor of retaining their abortion rights are largely arguments in favor of retaining their own victim status. It's a sad day all around when a group gains political power through being perceived as constant eternal victims, and sadder when that victimhood is largely an invention, a useful fiction. And what a twisting of the concept of compassion, she writes. Mm-hmm. We're pressed into demonstrating compassion for these victims or potential victims if back alley abortions threaten, while called to no compassion whatsoever for a defenseless unborn child.
Right.
She thanks you for your cogent arguments and your response to her email.
Yeah, this is a very perceptive insight by Susan, and it's one that is not usually made in this discussion. I hinted at it earlier when I talked about the so-called back alley abortion move that is made in favor of abortion rights, and that this is patronizing to women. It treats women like children, like victims, like they can't help themselves, and so the government has to step in and protect them in these circumstances. Yeah, it's the victim card is played in many circumstances, and it has a lot of appeal to people, but it really gets in the way of people thinking carefully about what is really going on here. The woman's not the victim here. The woman, in most of the cases of abortion, is an adult person who makes her own choices about her own sexuality, and in the midst of those choices, she gets herself in trouble. It is precisely the problem of free choice, or just simply choice, that that a young lady or an older woman is facing this this unwanted pregnancy, and then they want to be off the hook for the responsibility of it by claiming that they're victims. Well, look at if they're exercising their adult choice to do something that is risky with regards to abortion, and that is having sex. Well, then how is it that they're victims? They're not victims. They are reaping the results of their actions that they are choosing to do as adults. And if we want to treat these people as adults, all people as adults, then we have to treat them as adults. And not just pretend they're adults in some circumstances and then treat them like children in other circumstances.
This always comes up when we're discussing abortion and the debate, often from pro-life listeners who say, well, we talk a lot about the woman, the mother. Do we spend too much time talking about the mother and not enough about the father, the man, in the abortion equation?
Well, maybe some. I guess I'd have to say maybe. And I say that because I'm pausing for a moment to reflect, because I haven't given a lot of thought to this issue, Todd. I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, clearly there's a mother and a father here, and most of the emphasis is on the woman's right to do whatever she wants with her own body. I mean, that's the way the argument goes. Of course, it's not her own body that's in question. It's a body that it's a separate body that she has created that is domiciled in her womb where it belongs. Where he or she belongs, actually, because the fetus has a gender, and we forget that mom didn't do this on her own. That in just as much as mom has a responsibility for that child, so does dad. And in fact, the law acknowledges this. If this woman decides to keep her child, then by golly, dad is responsible. He has to care for that child by law. So both are involved here, and both are relevant parties. But the father is not considered at all in this issue of abortion. It is completely up to the mother to decide. The father cannot inveigh against the abortion if he wanted to. And many do. And here's the irony of the situation, Todd. This issue is cast as kind of a women's rights issue, and that men are in there, trying to enforce their will on women by arguing against abortion, like me and you right now. The fact of the matter is, women characteristically want their children, and it is more likely than not that the men in their life are going to push them into an abortion that they don't want. So it isn't really the woman's choice at all. There are men that are causing her to have this child when she doesn't, I mean, to have this abortion when she doesn't want to. And the reason is because the men are going to have to pay for that child if that child is about to live. And examples of this are everywhere. I mean, this is very, very common. And those who counsel women who are thinking about having an abortion realize that so much of the time it is the boyfriend or the stepfather or the uncle, you figure it out, who is pushing this young lady to have an abortion. She doesn't want to kill her baby, but the men in her life want her to. So the father enters into this equation in a couple of odd and interesting ways, and sometimes in ways that you don't expect, given the rank-and-file kind of propaganda on the pro-choice side here.
Greg Kokel is our guest, president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Tonight, we're responding to arguments, and sometimes they don't even amount to arguments, sometimes mere assertions or opinions, in favor of abortion rights. 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio with your questions or your comments on this subject. issuesetc@kfuo.org. issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, Greg raised the issue. What about rape and incest? Is it justification for abortion? That after this.
Is there a relationship between creation and salvation? The Issues Etc. Book of the Month for September is God Made It For You. It's a children's book on the creation story. For more information, find the cover of God Made It For You on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. God Made It For You is written by Issues Etc. regular guest Pastor Charles Lehman. God Made It For You.
If you enjoy listening to Issues Etc. on the weekends, did you know that you can listen to 12 new hours weekdays on the Internet? Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click Listen Online, and you'll find 12 new hours Monday through Friday. You can listen live on your PC, or on demand, or on your iPod or MP3 player. issuesetc.org, and tune in weekdays to 12 new hours of Issues Etc.
Where Christianity meets culture. You're listening to Issues Etc. Pro-life leader Dr. Lawrence White on why you should support Issues Etc.
In a culture that has forgotten about the truth of God, God's people need to stand upon His Word firmly and faithfully. Issues Etc. raises the questions that are in discussion in our society and in our church today, in a way that highlights the truth of God amid all the error and the falsehood of men. This is a program that is making a difference in our society, in our church, in our culture, to the glory of the Lord Jesus Christ.
You can support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. by making a tax-deductible gift this week. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Or you can make a credit card donation by calling our resource line at 1-800-737-0172.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. Greg Kokel is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Our call-in number 1-800-730-2727 or issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, you raised it before the break, before we go to the callers, very briefly. Rape and incest, do they justify abortion, Greg?
Well, this one's hard to deal with briefly, Todd. It isn't that the answer can't be given quickly. It's just that this is one of the questions when there's a lot more going on than just what, in a sense, the intellectual issue. When people ask about abortion in the case of rape, the challenge here is not to show that the unborn is human. The challenge is to show that you're human, you know. The very first question that you asked in the show had to do with a quote that somebody made about the pro-lifers are, you know, heartless, we don't care. And the fact is, when the issue of rape and incest comes up, and we then push, in a sense, against that and in favor of the child, it sounds to many people, though I don't think this is the case, but it sounds to many people like we don't care about the trauma. And I think it's very important for us to communicate to somebody who raises this issue, because many who have been raped raise the issue, to ask if their rapist was punished, which usually they haven't been. And to emphasize that rape is a terrible crime and should be punished to the fullest extent of the law, because the rapist forces a woman to become a mother, forces her into 9 months of pregnancy, forces her into childbirth, forces her into either giving the child up for adoption or caring for the child at the cost of a tremendous amount of money over the next 18 years. But that's truly a case where a woman is being forced into being a mother. But the real question is, who should pay for that? Should the child pay for that? Why should the child be punished for the crimes of the father? No one should be forced to do any of these things, but the fact is the mother has already been thrust into that position against her will. Now she is carrying a child. Now what is the right thing to do? Is the right thing to do to punish the child because the father was a criminal? And I think when we're careful to approach it that way, we demonstrate that we're human beings too, and we care about this woman who has gone through this tragic kind of experience. But at the same time, the tragedy of the experience does not justify taking the life of this innocent child. And so maintaining both of those truths is important as we communicate that. Now, let me make one other comment if I have a moment, Todd.
Sure.
From a policy perspective, I'm actually an incrementalist when it comes to the law here, because my goal is to try to save as many lives as possible. There are other pro-lifers who think that unless I can get a law that will abolish all abortions, then I am not going to vote in favor of it at all. There have been laws that have been suggested in certain states and under certain circumstances which abortion would be outlawed except for the case of incest and rape. Now I think that's morally inconsistent, but I think it's legally wise, because maybe I don't get those 6 to 8% or whatever it is, it's probably even a smaller percentage than that, of children saved who were conceived as a result of rape or incest. But if I pass this law, I will be able to save the other 96 or whatever percent of children who are aborted for completely different reasons and for almost frivolous reasons. So my goal is to save as many lives as I can, not go for an all-or-nothing approach. If I were a politician, from a policy perspective, I'd accept a law that said abortions are illegal except in the case of rape and incest. I'd accept it not because I think rape and incest are legitimate exceptions, because at closer analysis they aren't, based on the moral logic of the pro-life view. But on the rationale that I want to save as many lives as I can. You know, William Wilberforce, the one who was responsible for stopping the slave trade in the United Kingdom, and many people saw the movie Amazing Grace this last year, and it was a wonderful characterization of his life. He took an incrementalist approach to slavery. He said, first, let's stop the trade. Then let's stop slavery. And he knew that if he could stop the trade of slavery, then it would, you know, it would dry up slavery at its source, but that wouldn't do much for people who already were slaves. So for the first 20 years of his political life, he sought to end the slavery trade. It was the first step, and he was finally successful. And then he spent the rest of his life, save just a couple of days, trying to stop slavery. He died like 2 or 3 days after slavery was outlawed in the United Kingdom. And this before it was outlawed in the United States, so he paved the way for slavery to be outlawed in other parts of the world as well. But notice how he took an incrementalist approach. If he tried to get it all done in one fell swoop, it would have never happened at all. And so there's a certain type of political wisdom that has to be applied to these issues. And I think this is the case when we face the issues of rape and incest.
William in Parker, Colorado, listens on KRKS. William, thanks for waiting, and welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, how are you doing today?
Very well.
Hi, William.
You know, I was listening to you guys over the radio, and what's interesting is this. You know, abortion is just one of the many complex issues that we face in the world. And one of the things that I pay attention to is this. You know, things like this. This is what happens when you take God's authority out of a system. And, you know, this even goes back from Adam and Eve, and you know, you guys understand the story of Sodom and Gomorrah, and, you know, you've taken family traditions out of the home. You know, you look at the public school systems, they've taken God's authority out of the system. There's nothing biblical about our public school systems today. And what's interesting, when you look in our governmental system, they don't talk about God, they don't talk about Scripture, they've taken God's authority out of the system to rely on their own understanding.
True. Right.
William, thank you very much for the call. This is, of course, as he pointed out, a far more complex subject than we could deal with here, but what do you think about the the root causes, the climate for abortion on demand here.
Well, there's no question that as we get further and further away from grounding our moral responsibilities in an accurate way, that is with God, that we get further and further away from accountability and more kind of into our own thing and finding ways to justify our own irresponsibility. And you know, I think that abortion is just one of those examples, and William cited a number of them. I do want to say something, though, Todd. Maybe I don't know if we disagree on this or not, but, you know, there is a certain kind of complexity about abortion in that there are all kinds of things that people will raise, as you've been raising these examples of objections and things that people bring up. But I find that most of these things are red herrings. They don't really go to the issues at hand or to the moral logic of the pro-life view. And I find that it is actually helpful for us, and we hinted at this in the first hour, to simplify the issue. I actually think it is simple in the sense of coming to a conclusion about what the right answer is morally about abortion. If we answer the one question, what is the unborn, we've answered all of the other issues. None of these things are questions about how you deal with a four-year-old. Because we would never say, you know, rape or incest is a good reason to kill a four-year-old, or the fact you can't afford the four-year-old, or it's burdensome to the four-year-old, or with a four-year-old. All of those things are inconsequential when you think of the magnitude of and value of the life of the four-year-old. You never even think of this kind of thing. It only comes up with the unborn because the unborn is hidden from sight and we don't know it yet in a personal way, and so it seems easy just to abort the child and kill the child and then move on with our lives. And so we raise these kinds of what I think ultimately are empty and vacuous kind of excuses for it. But if we apply the same excuses to the four-year-old, we would never even countenance taking that child's life for those reasons. And that's why the question, as you mentioned at the end of last hour, what is the unborn? What is that thing? Is the most important question. If, in fact, the unborn is the same, morally speaking, as the four-year-old, not the same size, not the same shape, not the same capabilities, not the same dependency, but the essentially the same valuable human being, then whatever restrictions we have on how we treat the four-year-olds should apply just as equally to the unborn.
Greg Kokel is our guest. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get more of his thoughts as we respond to arguments for abortion rights. Stay tuned. Pastor John Folley of LCMS World Relief on its ongoing efforts to help the victims of Hurricane Katrina.
We are continuing to be involved in the response to Hurricane Katrina, continuing to partner with the Southern District and meeting the long-range and long-term needs of the Lutheran churches and schools and church workers and the community at large through Camp Restore with helping them to rebuild.
To find out how you can continue to support the victims of Hurricane Katrina, look for the LCMS World Relief logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call 1-888-930-4438. Ask about Camp Restore, 1-888-930-4438, LCMS World Relief.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Todd Wilkin here again, talking with Pastor Matt Harrison, Executive Director of LCMS World Relief, about the world's AIDS crisis. Matt, talk about how the AIDS crisis especially affects children.
Nearly 20% of AIDS deaths are children. Children who, through absolutely no ethical or moral fault of their own, have this curse upon them. And these are children where it's very easy to look upon them in pictures and say, well, they are those children. But then you meet them, each one of them, and you hear each one's name. And you talk to them about where they go to church and what they dream about and what they would like to have in their little lives. Something as simple as a chair, let alone a toy or a bed. or somebody who loves them, and you can't but respond.
How is LCMS World Relief and the many who support it, how are they responding to this crisis?
Traditionally, we've done most of the response by way of education. That is, we've provided resources to our partners, many in Africa, but also AIDS in Thailand becomes is becoming an extreme challenge, and also in Russia, providing dollars so that pastors, church workers, health workers can be trained on AIDS. So education is very important, and we believe education is really key within a strong Lutheran context of law and gospel, and one that has a proper understanding of sexuality as God's gift, and the blessings that that God gives us there, and the blessings of faithfulness and monogamy. So that has been important. We have, in the last several years, been very active with several orphanages in Kenya, and that has been just a wonderful joy. We just finished building a brand-new orphanage that houses about 60 children. It's amazing. For about $30,000, we were able to build a complete orphanage. We just added to the Matango Orphanage in western Kenya an entire medical clinic for really very little money comparatively. And we're increasingly going in this direction, providing resources for congregations in Africa so they can deal with their own HIV/AIDS orphans.
LCMS World Relief offers Christ-centered, cross-focused help to victims of the world's AIDS crisis. For more information about LCMS World Relief, find them at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call them toll-free 1-888-930-4438. LCMS World Relief, concerned for both body and soul. Folks, some are saying that the flooding in Southeast Asia is the worst in recent memory. More than 2,000 people have died in India alone. Now, you can help these victims by making a tax-deductible gift to LCMS World Relief. Their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438. Earmark your gift to Asia Flooding. That's Asia Flooding. 1-888-930-4438. Or find out more about LCMS World Relief at our website, issuesetc.org. Pastor Matt Harrison and LCMS World Relief. Listening in Port Orchard, Washington on KGNW. Karen, welcome to Issues Etc. Hi, Karen.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. What's your question or comment for Greg?
Well, I just agree with him on everything he said, because if we weren't with child, we wouldn't be termed pregnant. So it's a human being, whether it's unborn or after it's born. And why should we be able to kill our children before they're born and not after? I mean, it just doesn't even make sense. And I had an abortion, and I really wish somebody would have saved me from that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And fortunately for me, God gave me the opportunity to save someone from making that decision, and they are crazy about that baby.
Karen, thank you very much for your call, and thanks for listening in Washington. Greg, your response?
Yeah, her comment, it's just so so appropriate, I guess. You know, people say they're with child. No, duh. I mean, that's so obvious, isn't it? It's with child means to be with child. Though people didn't say this by accident. It wasn't because they were naive and they didn't understand the science behind it. It's because they understood that within them was growing their own human child. And they had a responsibility for guarding and protecting that child. You know, just yesterday, Todd, when I was up in Oakland, California at a conference, I met a young man. He was probably about 13 or 14 years old. He was going to this conference, this apologetics conference, and a conferee, and having a great time and learning a lot from the speakers that were there. I met his mother first, because she brought him to our table after I had talked with her, and she told me that I saved I adopted a boy that I saved from an abortion. Now, she didn't do it directly. What happened is she was counseling in front of an abortion clinic, and a young lady came out of the abortion clinic having just gone in, and she had an ultrasound. She was ready to have an abortion. She was all ready, and she asked to see the ultrasound. And the nurse there, whoever was attending it, she said, "I can't show you the ultrasound. I'll lose my job." In other words, the nurse would lose her job for showing the woman what her own child looked like on the ultrasound. Finally, she persuaded her to turn the screen towards her. She looked at the screen, saw the unborn child in her womb, and got up and walked out. And when she walked out of the center, she ran into this woman, Melinda, who had been counseling people about their abortion. And she told her what was going on. Melinda said, "Call me anytime, 24/7. I'll do whatever I can for you." She ended up carrying to term that young lady, and Melinda adopted that child. And that was the 13-year-old young man that I met yesterday, who was just beaming and so happy to see me. And I was very touched by the story as well.
Byron in Berkeley, California, listens on KFAX. Hi, Byron.
Hello. Can you hear me all right, sir?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, hi,
very
Byron.
Well. My off-guard comment from a woman when I was walking to Safeway is that what about a miscarriage, say, from an animal or from a human being, too? Wouldn't that not be considered the same thing? And I wasn't able and prepared to answer that kind of a question.
Well,
and I'm pro-life. I'm pro-life, by the way.
All right, Byron, thank you very much. What about the miscarriage?
A miscarriage is a sacrificed human life. I mean, yes, it would be the same thing in that a human life is sacrificed. It isn't the same thing in the sense that we were the ones who sacrificed that life. A miscarriage is a natural death of an unborn child, and the body expels it. And you know, my wife had a miscarriage. We lost a baby in 2002, rather. And I got to tell you something. It was very, very hard on my wife because she knew that what she lost wasn't a what, but a who. People have brought up the issue of miscarriage before, and I know Byron wasn't advancing this, but maybe somebody that he was talking to at the store, the Safeway there, was that somehow since there are, in a sense, natural abortions, spontaneous abortions, miscarriages, then maybe it should be okay for us to have planned abortions or designed abortions. And that's like saying because people die of a heart attack, we should be allowed to kill people. After all, they're going to die anyway. They do die by natural means, so why shouldn't it be okay for us to do it by unnatural means? I mean, this is a silly way of arguing. Miscarriages are tragic for women who have them because they know they've lost a child. That gives no legitimacy to doing it on purpose in the case of abortion.
Tim in Montana emails us, "How common is it for a man to fight to keep the baby during an unplanned pregnancy? When the woman would prefer to abort, I know of one such instance in my personal experience," says Tim.
Yeah, I think it's more rare that the husband wants to keep the child, and I'm not in any position to tell you how frequently that happens, but I can tell you anecdotally for myself, I have been aware of many more cases where the woman was feeling pressured by the man instead of, as opposed to the man wanting to keep the child and the woman wanting to abort. I almost never hear that, but I have to say that my exposure is somewhat limited to the personal stories. However, of the personal stories I've heard, I am aware of a number of cases where it was the man pressuring the woman to get the abortion, or the young lady, as the case may be.
Let's talk about that term of art, a political term now, not abortion rights, although it's sometimes put that way crassly, more often than not, reproductive rights. Is this a human rights / women's rights issue?
Well, I think the question of rights legitimately enters into it. But in the sense that we have the appropriate expectation to be left alone by government when there isn't a weighty concern at stake. And I think this is what is kind of behind this sloppy slogan, "Keep your laws off my body." We heard that being chanted in one of the spots that you ran. But the question I ask is it ever legitimate for the government to legislate in such a way that it limits your personal freedom? And by the way, all legislation limits people's personal freedom. I mean, every law, in a sense, is slapped on someone's body. So the alternative having your laws on your body is to have no laws at all, because laws restrict human beings from certain behaviors, and that's a restriction of your body. So anarchy is the answer to that. The fact is, and I had a woman in an airport once raise this issue for me. We were sitting there ready for a flight, and I said, you know, ma'am, it's interesting that the law slapped all kinds of body laws, the government slapped all kinds of laws onto your body when you crossed over the curb and entered into this airport, and you didn't seem to object one bit. So there are times when it's legitimate for the government to do that. We all acknowledge that. Anarchy is the only alternative. So the real question is, when is it legitimate? And I think it's fair to ask that question to people. When can the government use its force to limit your freedom? And I think if a person is thoughtful about it, they'll realize that, well, when my liberty begins to infringe on somebody else's well-being, that's when the law has the appropriate latitude to step in and limit my liberty. Well, that's exactly what's at question here. The unborn is a valuable human being, at least arguably. This is what pro-lifers believe, and they're willing to make their case for that. And if it is, in fact, a valuable human being, no less valuable than a four-year-old, then it seems the law is within its rights, the government is within its rights, slapping laws on a woman's body to protect that valuable human being that is in the care of the woman, in this case, in the care of the woman by being domiciled in her body, but no less in the care than a four-year-old who lives in her home.
Tim's listening in Wisconsin on WEMI. Tim, welcome to Issues Etc. What's your question or comment?
Was abortion made legal for the people in the sexual revolution who decided that free love, free sex, you know,
yeah,
a way to cover up their actions?
Oh, that's
so that
a
no
very it's a very interesting question, Tim. In fact, perhaps unwittingly insightful question about Roe v. Wade. What was the reasoning there, Greg?
Well, you know, here you've got, you know, again, you're dealing with these issues on two different levels. You have the legal reason and the kind of de facto reason, you know, the legal reason and the real reason kind of thing. The legal reason had to do with, and this is the Roe v. Wade kind of argument, which I think is rather vacuous and has been shown since then to be inadequate, but we're still stuck with the decision. And that is that the Constitution guarantees a right to privacy. What is more private than a relationship between a doctor and that doctor's patient? And since this is a medical procedure between the doctor and a patient, the government should not be involved. So you have a constitutional argument based on privacy. But that's the legal argument. What is really driving this? I actually think that Tim is insightful in identifying the kind of frame of mind that came before this. This is 1971, Roe versus Wade. Did I get that date right?
73.
73.
Yeah, 73. And you've got about 20 seconds.
Okay, 73. But what happened before it? A decade of the 60s. I grew up in that decade. I was born in 1950. I was a teenager in the 60s. I know what people were thinking and doing and campaigning for. And this, what happened in 1973, was a natural outgrowth of that ethic in the 60s.
Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California. He's co-authored the book Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Mid-Air. When we come back, 10 more minutes with Greg talking about abortion rights and the arguments for and against. Now, you can check out the website for Stand to Reason by going to our website, issuesetc.org. Just look under that section titled Links on the left-hand side of the homepage. Click it, scroll down. Greg Kokel is there and a link to Stand to Reason. Issuesetc.org is our homepage address. When we come back, we'll pick up right there where we left off with Greg and then answer these ultimate questions when someone says, look, it's this simple, the unborn simply isn't a human person. We'll be right back. Why is historical theology important to the training of future pastors? Issues Etc. regular guest Dr. Larry Rast.
We live in a day when people are largely ignorant of their past. And what we find as we gaze into our past is that many of the challenges that we face in the present have already been dealt with by the church. What historical theology does is prepare us to speak to the challenges of our times with the unchanging truth of Christ. Historical theology, therefore, is not some pie-in-the-sky abstract endeavor. It has an ultimately practical purpose, and that is preaching Christ and Him crucified and risen.
For more information on Concordia Seminary St. Louis and Concordia Theological Seminary Fort Wayne, check out our website, issuesetc.org, Concordia Seminary St. Louis, serving church and world, Concordia Theological Seminary Fort Wayne, teach, reach, care.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Issues Etc. has its supporters.
I just want to say that I really like your show. It's really helped me. I'm currently in my preparation to enter Concordia Seminary, and this show, I think, has really helped me with my progress. So I just want to say thanks and keep it up.
We also have our share of detractors.
This message that you're sending out is not the message that God wants the people to hear. You don't have a clue as to what He wants. You are all sinners, and you shall rot for eternity for this. You people are insane. Just burn in hell.
That's exactly why we have the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 314-505-7825. Agree or disagree with something you've heard? Call the Issues Etc. listener comment line, 314-505-7825. The Issues Etc. listener comment line, available for your comments, positive and negative, 24/7, 314-505-7825.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. 10 more minutes with Greg Kokel, answering arguments for abortion rights. We do have several resources that will help you defend the pro-life position posted under the What's New section of our website, including several written by our guest, Greg Kokel, issuesetc.org. Listening in San Jose, California, Elijah, and he's listening on KFAX. Elijah, welcome.
Hello.
Hello, Elijah. What's your question or comment?
I was wondering if he could please interpret maybe for the audience. I don't know if Exodus 21, verse 22 through 25 might be of any relevance to the conversation. I saw that, you know, God showed his concern for children. For babies in the womb. I was wondering if maybe help me out here.
Elijah, thank you very much, and thanks for listening in San Jose. Okay. What about those passages he referenced in Exodus, Greg, and do they have a bearing on this entire conversation?
I think they do. Thank you, Elijah. This is a passage I've actually written about. I think you can find something on our website regarding it. In fact, I have the article right in front of me right now, because it is often used as a biblical argument against pro-life, because what the passage says in Exodus 21, verse 22 and following, is that if men struggle with a woman who is pregnant, and she has a miscarriage, then the man has to pay a fine. But if the woman is harmed or injured, if there's further injury, then the penalty is life for life. Now it looks like the scripture is dealing with the unborn as a less valuable entity than the woman. Because if the unborn dies, the miscarriage, well, then there's a penalty, but it is financial, and it's consequential by comparison to if the woman dies herself, then it's life for life. It looks like it doesn't treat, the text does not treat the baby in the womb as a full human being. But this is actually an error of translation, because what the text actually says in the Hebrew, it says, if the men are struggling and the baby comes out, that's it, and the baby comes out. Now, in the English translations, it's often translated miscarriage, although the New American, I think the New American Standard does have, she has a miscarriage. We assume in the English word miscarriage that the baby, it comes out dead, because that's the sense of the word miscarriage. However, in the original Hebrew word, when it says the baby comes out or comes forth, there is no sense of the death of the child in that. In fact, there are many, many places in the Hebrew scriptures where the same characterization of verbs is used, and it really means the coming forth of something living. Indeed, in the early chapters of Genesis, it says that the living vegetation came forth from the land. The problem here is assuming that when the passage says comes forth, that it means that the baby has come forth dead, but there's nothing like that in the original. So when you read the original as it's written, it says if the baby comes out, there is a fine. But if there is further injury, it is life for life, tooth for tooth, that kind of thing. So if the baby, if there is a premature birth, there is a fine. But if there is a death, and here it doesn't distinguish between the mother or the child that dies prematurely, then it shall be a life for life. I actually think this is a pro-life verse, not a pro-choice verse, but it suffers because of the unfortunate rendering of certain translations in verse 22 there. So I would encourage people, if they want more information on this, to go to our website at str.org and then just type in the word Exodus 21 and see if this article comes up. I think it will, and then you can get more detail on it. It's an important passage, though, because a lot of people bring this up.
Listening on KMCV in Jefferson City, Missouri, Bob, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, good evening. I was wanting to propose a new argument to use for to oppose abortion. And I was defining abortion or choice as when a mother hires a peg killer to assassinate her child still in her womb, and no one gets charged with murder. Now, we should not, in a civilized society, we should not allow one group of people to dominate another group of people to the point of murder and so forth. We fought World War II. The Nazis were doing that. It was occurring in slavery, buying and selling and sexually abusing the young girls and so forth. We should just say that this has no place in the civilized society, and there's precedent for that. There's biblical precedent.
Sure.
The All Bible says a lot about how you treat other people and treat other groups.
Bob, thank you very much. Okay, he made the analogy of a person hiring, I guess you'd say, a hitman to off someone. Is the analogy accurate when it comes to a woman and her abortionist?
Well, in real terms, I think it is, because a woman is hiring a person to take the life of another human being. I mean, that's the raw facts of the matter. But I don't think this is a good approach. And God bless Bob for bringing it up, because I think he's speaking very clearly and bluntly about the facts of the matter. But remember, we have a persuasive element here. We're trying to persuade people. And if a person thinks that you are loading up the argument with powerful language and rhetoric, then they're going to recoil at that. I think we have to make the case that the unborn is a genuine and valuable human being, and that taking its life is wrong, before we can then assert that this is like hiring a hitman. That really amounts to kind of announcing our conclusion without giving our argument, and we're announcing it in such raw and powerful and loaded terms that I think it's going to cause people just simply to disregard our point because they think we're playing with words when we talk that way. So though I agree with Bob in his point, I think that as a tactical move, it would not be helpful.
Finally, then, let's go back to the center of the issue, as you've pointed out many times here, and make this case. The person will just baldly assert as an argument in favor of abortion rights, the unborn is not a human person. Respond, if you would, in the next few minutes here.
Yeah,
as we
of course.
Our conversation.
And this is one of the hardest to deal with, Todd, because it seems like a sophisticated philosophic move. Again, I want to make the observation, this is not an argument. This is an assertion. If somebody thinks that the human being is not a person, they have to give you the unborn. They have to give you reasons why it wouldn't qualify. Now, my favorite tactic at this point is a very simple use of the Colombo tactic, and we've talked about that before on your show a number of times, Todd, and that's to ask a question, but it's a very pointed question. When a person says, all right, I concede that the unborn is a human being, but it's not a person, my question is simply this: what's the difference? In other words, what's the difference between a human being and a human person? Now, they have an obligation to offer the distinction. And here's the reason why, Todd. They have just divided humanity into two groups: human beings who are persons and human beings who are not persons. It is you can't kill human beings who are persons, and if you do, then you suffer the greatest penalties of the law. But human beings who are not persons, it's open season on them. So therefore, you better be very, very clear on where the dividing line happens to be. And most people are not going to be able to give you a dividing line. They haven't thought it out. This move to say they're humans but not persons is just a rhetorical move. It is a verbal sleight of hand to disqualify certain members of the human family from being bona fide and protected members of the human community.
20 seconds.
And so there is no relevant difference, to be honest with you. Size, level of development, environment, degree of dependency, those are the only kinds of differences between the unborn and the born. And it turns out none of those things, size or dependency or level of development, none of those things matter to human value. Human value is intrinsic and innate, and we ought to honor it on both sides of the womb.
To find out how to contact our guests tonight, Greg Kokel and Stand to Reason, or to join our monthly or annual donor program, the Issues Etc. Reformation Club, just call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. Visit our website, issuesetc.org, or write us, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Greg Kokel is president of Stand to Reason, based in Signal Hill, California, co-author of the book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair. Greg, as usual, it's always a pleasure, and thank you for being our guest.
It has been a pleasure for me, too, Todd. Thanks again.
Our Lord Jesus defines the neighbor not from the top down, but from the bottom up. This is an insight that I think is very useful when it comes to once we've got to the biological question, who is the unborn? Next comes the theological question, is that unborn person my neighbor? Well, Jesus was once asked a question, who is my neighbor? And he told that story of the Good Samaritan. And the upshot of that parable is, in fact, that from Jesus' perspective, the neighbor is defined from the least, the most helpless, the most hopeless up, and not from the most able and the most obvious down. Jesus says, everyone's your neighbor. You cannot exclude anyone from that category of being your neighbor. If Jesus defines it from the bottom up, from the least up, then we are certainly to include among our neighbors whom we serve and love in the name of Jesus Christ and protect the unborn. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen each week to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at kfuo.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of Worldwide KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.